little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelich, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Menten. Hey, Julia.
Today's topic, we're going to have updates on the world of teaching critical thinking, a favorite topic of ours here. We're going to hear what's new with the website Thinking is Power and the Mental Immunity Project and the value of multidisciplinary collaborative efforts to clean up our information environment.
And from her appreciation of critical thinking, information literacy, and science literacy, our guest, biology professor Melanie Tresick King from Massasoit's Community College in Massachusetts, created a general education biology course around those three themes. And she's also developed a resource-rich website called, as Julia mentioned, Thinking is Power. And later, she collaborated with author, researcher, and public philosopher Andy Norman and others to create the Mental Immunity Project. Melanie Tresick King, welcome for the second time to Thinking Clearly.
Thank you so much. I'm so honored to be back on. You have an amazing podcast, and I'm so happy to see you again.
Thank you for joining us again. You were on a previous podcast. And so for listeners who may not have heard that previous conversation with you, episode number 74, maybe you could just give us a quick summary on how a community college biology professor became an innovative teacher and advocate for critical thinking.
This is such an important story to me. I was teaching intro bio, which for people who don't want to be scientists when they grow up, non-science majors, they usually take intro bio for their science elective. And I taught that course for probably a dozen years, and I was really trying to teach it in a way that I thought would be useful to students and interesting. And I just realized that how science learns is more important than what science knows. So the facts, the things that we learn from science, the facts and the explanations, those things are inseparable. Like, we carry in our pockets access to basically all of the world's information. We also carry access to the world's misinformation. So the question is, when you need to find reliable information, can you find it? And can you use it to make better decisions? So I talked to the department and we had some really great conversations and decided to get rid of that course and replace it with one I designed to be fair. I begged, borrowed, and stole a bunch of information and tried to make it my own, right? Nothing is new under the sun. But the goal is to teach critical thinking, information literacy, and science literacy. In that order, I have found is the most useful. You have to learn how to think critically before you get to information. And you have to learn why science is necessary before you get to the process of science. The course has gone through several iterations at this point, but it's really something I think works quite well. I use a lot of pseudoscience in class. So like my students right now are making advertisements for fake health pseudoscience products. And we just finished Bigfoot, and before that was ghosts and UFOs.
We would love to hear an update on that class. It's called Bio 101, Science for Life, and see how it's going. For example, have there been any changes since we talked to you last, new directions? And I'm interested, are there clones? Have people picked up and are starting to do this same sort of thing in the various subjects at other colleges, universities, high schools?
Yeah, that's such a good question. The course itself has now gone through three major iterations, and I'm a perfectionist, so it's probably not done. But right now, I think it's a model that works quite well. I have given the course or aspects of the course to other gen ed science professors at colleges and universities. But more what I'm trying to do recently is reach other educators and help them in their classes. So I've been speaking at science educator conferences primarily and offering aspects of the curriculum that I know that they're taking back. So K-12, especially junior high and high school, middle and high school, those educators have a lot to teach and they're often required to have their students pass various exams. They have set curriculum, set standards. They don't have a ton of flexibility, but there's still a great hunger from these educators because they're really trying and they know that it's necessary. Been doing the most with science educators, but I've also had a lot of interest from English, from social studies, from history, these skills are applicable in a variety of topics. So that's mostly what's happening right now, is a lot of teacher outreach and giving curriculum. The first article that I wrote about the class was called Teach Skills, Not Facts. And the idea was the critical thinking, information literacy, and science literacy skills, as opposed to the content of science. I stole that title, from my husband, who is a conductor. And for a long time, he was a conductor of a children's choir. And he would always say that he taught skills, not songs, right? And he would say, like, I do this because I'm lazy, because I don't want every time that I give them a new song to have to start from scratch. So I teach them the skills. So when I put a song in front of them, they have the skills to be able to learn those songs. And one morning we were chatting, I had the article ready to go. It didn't have a title. And I'm like, holy crapola, I am literally doing what you're doing, but for science. And I've noticed now that that way of looking at education, focusing on the methodologies of that particular field, as opposed to its findings, is a much bigger bang for your buck. And educators, I think broadly, are they're really trying. And I'm here to assist them if they want the curriculum.
The idea being that students will remember and assimilate the methodology, but forget the facts. People take classes and do forget the facts. And that's kind of the way our memory works, right? We remember the structure of things, and sometimes we forget the facts, and then we have to make up facts to accommodate those that we forgot. That's a great approach. I think I looked at the class schedule, and it looks like that's an online class.
Yeah, so you've done your homework on this one. I love that. Technically, I am currently on a leave of absence from my full-time position to write a book. We can talk about that later if you want to, but I am currently not in person right now. So I am teaching the class online. Thankfully, I had the class online before the pandemic, and the pandemic forced us all to go online. I'm still doing the online version and not in face-to-face.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Now, how would students, if they wanted to take that class and they were in California, for example, how would they go about doing that?
One of the beauties of the community college system is that it's open access. You need to go through registration to make sure that you are a Massasoit student, but that is a really easy process. The math and language requirements are specifically quite low for this class. And so I think there's some basic pretesting to be able to get into those. Once you do, then yeah, anybody can sign up for it and check your transfer institutions, but it should transfer as a science elective and or more broadly as a social sciences elective to the vast majority of colleges and universities.
So that actually might be a good link for us to include how a person outside of the state that you're teaching in could actually sign up for that class. Because part of what we do on this show is we want to provide resources for listeners. And a lot of the feedback that we get are actually thanking us for that. I didn't know about such and such. And thank you so much for having this person as a guest, because now I'm involved with that activity one way or the other. So that's great. Good to hear.
I'm still thinking about making advertisements for Bigfoot. For folks who haven't heard the previous episode, could you maybe help us understand how a project like that helps achieve those goals of teaching critical thinking skills?
I'm having my students create advertisements for health pseudoscience products, fake ones that they've made up. So the idea behind this comes from inoculation theory, which is the idea that exposing people to bits of misinformation can help them build a resistance to it in the real world. And one of my favorite approaches is to have them create it. So I have my students create a variety of different types of misinformation. In this particular case, right now they're currently working on it. So I don't have this semester's examples quite yet, but students are really creative and I love when they make me laugh. And so they tend to have a lot of fun with this project.
Great. And you also have a really fantastic website. We've mentioned it already here. Thinking is Power. People can find it at thinkingispower.com. What's new? What's happening on your website?
Yeah. So Thinking is Power, the idea is based on knowledge power, but there's just too much to know. So thinking is also power. And the big projects on the website right now are really expanding my social media outreach to video. Previously, video has scared the poo out of me, and it still kind of does. But I'm trying to do more with like TikTok and Instagram and, you know, the Facebook Reels and even YouTube. So I've been doing a lot of video outreach, and this seems to be going really well. People like the short form video, and I am terrible with social media. I do it because I have to and because it's a great way to get the message out there. People kept telling me to be on TikTok. And over the summer, I was in Mexico and people said, TikTok, TikTok. And I'm like, I don't get this app. I don't, like, what is this app about? So I pulled it up. I remember being at a restaurant in Mexico and I was flipping through TikTok, looking at these videos going, this is just an assault on the senses. Like, it's just like people dancing and flashing lights and weird face things and whatever. And then I found a cat video, and my kryptonite is cat videos. And it was a cat that name is Bagel, and Bagel was standing on her owner's back, reaching up for a ceiling fan, playing with the little chain. And Bagel got too high. And then you heard like a thud, 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 thud. And she's like, Bagel, no. And then there was this little crop to Bagel with a shorn head. And I laughed so hard. I think I probably drew attention to myself in the whole restaurant. The point was, first, TikTok does have a brilliant model, and that model's primary purpose is cat videos. And I love the platform, but I can't compete with cat videos. So my cat Dimitri now shows up in many of my and my cat's name, by the way, is Dmitri Shostakovich, because my husband, again, is a conductor.
Sounds like an excellent modern marketing strategy these days. Yes. I noticed you can also find them on YouTube, is another good one for people who aren't into all the apps.
Melanie, you mentioned mental immunity, and there is such a thing as a mental immunity project that we'll talk about in some detail here. It's a collaborative collection of scientists and researchers and change agents, they use that word in their webpage, focused on the idea, quote, how to protect minds from the worst forms of cognitive contagion. And actually, you talked about getting into video. You're featured in a video introducing the basic ideas on the website, mentalimmunityproject.org. Give us the backstory on how that collaboration came about.
So the Mental Immunity Project is Andy Norman's. So Andy Norman is a philosopher, and several years ago, he released a book called Mental Immunity. And he, after the book was released, created a research collaborative. So it's called CIRCE, the Cognitive Immunology Research Collaborative, a collection of scholars, researchers, philosophers who are trying to understand cognitive immunology or mental immunity. And last summer, we had a panel with some of the primary people associated with the project, and decided that we needed a front-facing group. So that front-facing group now is called the Mental Immunity Project. I am the education director for the Mental Immunity Project. And I lovingly write to all of the nerds out there, nerds are awesome, but these are specific kinds of nerds that produce great research and great scholarship, and they don't always translate that to the public in the most understandable way, which is what the Mental Immunity Project is trying to do. It's taking the research and the scholarship from CIRCE, the Cognitive Immunology Research Collaborative, and making it available to people so that they can use it. And Lee McIntyre is one of the board members and founding members. You mentioned him earlier. The basic idea is that if you think of the mind as having an immune system, actually, let me back up for a second. I'm a critical thinking educator. And what I learned in the process of teaching critical thinking is that I thought I was teaching critical thinking. And it was only until I created a course that was specifically designed around critical thinking that I wasn't actually teaching critical thinking. All educators think that they are teaching critical thinking. And I will just speak for myself here. I didn't know I wasn't until I learned that I wasn't. And when something has so many different definitions and so many ways to put it into practice, it becomes really difficult for the average person to, okay, what does it mean to think critically? And you can't teach it if you can't really clearly understand it. So when I use cognitive immunology or mental immunity, I will explain it in a way that I think is useful for people to think about their thinking. So imagine your mind has an immune system, and it has filters built in where some information gets passed and some doesn't. Now, the problem is we can become infected with information that's not true, with misinformation, with information that's harmful to us, and we can spread it to others. We already use a lot of the words around mental immunity more broadly. For example, we will say that information goes viral. We'll say that we are in an infodemic. We'll say that someone is infected with conspiracy theories, or they're immune to information. So those words are already part of our vernacular. This framework helps to organize those principles in a way that I think helps people visualize their thinking process in a way that's useful to them, to be able to build up their filters to let in just the good and less of the bad, for example. So that's how the project got started. We have a website, mentalimmunityproject.org. We've got some basic guidelines for what mental immunity is and the principles. It's basically good thinking, but it's organized around this, what I think is a really useful analogy.
In terms of making contact and networking with Andy Norman, who we have had as a guest on Thinking Clearly when his book came out, and Lee McIntyre, and those folks, they both consider themselves public philosophers. So I can see there's kind of a natural connection between Andy Norman and Lee. But how did you get into that network? The interesting question to me is, how do people with similar interests and ideas on how their interests can mesh with someone else's, how do people make that connection and then grow that into something that becomes powerful because people are taking a slightly different look at it and working on a different aspect of it, and they're working together?
If I've learned anything, is that this is a really small world, and the diversity of ideas really helps, the diversity of perspectives really helps to test an idea, and hopefully the idea that survives is the strongest form of that. Actually, in my class in Science for Life, I was using inoculation theory, and I specifically active technique-based inoculation, where I was having my students create misinformation using the techniques of misinformation. And I had previously contacted John Cook. He's another misinformation researcher who does a lot of inoculation theory. I had previously been in contact with him and helped him with his game, testing his game Cranky Uncle in class, and had created several other assignments. And I saw Andy posting on social media, and he was posting about mental immunity. And I made a comment on there, like, you know, actually, I do some of this stuff in my class. And next thing you know, he's messaging me saying, hey, why don't you call me? We'll talk. And so, you know, that was, I don't know, 18, 24 months ago. And now it's grown into something much greater. But yeah, all of that was, I don't know, right place at the right time. I got lucky and I'm having a great time.
But the venue then was social media, bringing some people with like interests together. So that's the upside, positive part of social media. We complain about social media a lot, but that's the part that actually works and brings people together. You know, I'm not a big Twitter fan, but I guess that's one of the strengths of Twitter.
Well, we touched on this a little bit earlier, inoculation theory. You know, so we've been talking about mental immunity, or also called cognitive immunity, and that is based on inoculation theory, all part of this kind of analogy of the immune system. So maybe you could give us a little bit of background on that, on the inoculation theory and how that works, and why you do these exercises in your class.
So inoculation theory was first proposed by a psychologist named William McGuire in the 50s and 60s. And at the time, the Korean War had just ended. And in particular, there were some American soldiers that had defected to North Korea. And it was really confounding people why Americans would choose to defect to a communist country. And the assumption was that they were brainwashed. And McGuire started looking into this and proposed what we know today as inoculation theory. So the idea is that if you expose a mind to a bit of misinformation, along with how that misinformation works or why it's wrong, then in the real world, people become inoculated against it. And it actually laid low for quite some time. And I desperately lose track of time, but I'm guessing somewhere around the aughts, it picked back up again. There's some great inoculation researchers today. So John Cook, I've already mentioned, Sander van der Linden, he has a great new book out called
Foolproof.
Thank you. It's brilliant. And his student, John Rosenbeek, who's now not his student anymore. There's also Josh Compton in the US, Stephen Lewandowski. And they are doing some really interesting research into how to use inoculation theory to inoculate people against misinformation. There are different types of inoculation. And John Cook and I have a new paper out in one of the things we try to do is organize the different types of inoculation into a way that conceptually makes sense and also is a sort of a recipe for what educators can use to make exercises. So there's passive versus active inoculation, where passive inoculation is where you explain why misinformation is wrong, whereas active is where they create misinformation. So they basically make their own antibody by creating it. There's also fact-based versus technique-based. So fact-based would be, here's the facts that are wrong, versus the technique is, here's how the misinformation misleads, the techniques that it uses. There's also one called source-based, but that one is less studied. There's humorous versus non-humorous. I particularly prefer humorous. So a lot of the exercises that I do in class are based on active technique-based that uses humor. In that, I have students create misinformation using the techniques of that misinformation. So we've already talked about the pseudoscience ad. So for example, we'll talk about health pseudoscience. And here are the things that pseudoscience, practitioners of pseudoscience use to sell their products. I have an article called How to Sell Pseudoscience in Skeptical Inquirer last year. Based on that, then the students use those techniques to create advertisements that they might see on social media, like a Instagram or a TikTok or something. And they'll create an ad. I give them options. So the best-selling forms of health pseudoscience are weight loss. They are muscle building. There's looking younger. And I teach a college class. So a lot of my students like the fourth option, which is male enhancement. And so they then have to use the techniques to sell those in a way where it's misleading, but looks like something they would see. And what's the best is students will come back and go, I just saw this thing on Instagram, and it's exactly like something that we would create in class, right? It's so brilliant how they have fun with it. The whole point is to have a good time with it, but to use the techniques that mislead, that that misinformation's form of techniques to convince others to buy it. I'm using air quotes for those of you who can't see me. And in the process, they can see it in the real world. I do other things like I have them create conspiracy theories or argue illogically. I teach them how to be psychics and do cold reading. And in the process, it's just they learn how that misinformation misleads and they can see it in the real world and not be fooled for it. It's a game. It's fun. The whole intention is to inoculate them against it in the real world using inoculation theory.
Well, I have a real life connection with this background that you give about William McGuire and his research being motivated by apparent brainwashing during the Korean War, prisoners of war, in that, and it must have been 59 or 60 in my civics class, that's how old I am, in high school. And our teacher, I don't recall his name, but he was a good teacher. He showed us some films of the brainwashing that was going on. I don't know how they got these films, but they had films where they were debriefing the prisoners of war. Some of them elected to stay with their captors and denounce the United States. And his point in showing us that at that time was that he wanted to reinforce why it was important for us as students to learn about our democratic institutions. If you teach something poorly, then it is easier, it becomes easier to change that belief to the opposite. In other words, if you teach the value of democratic institutions poorly, the person learning that does not have all the information they need to ward off someone else who's challenging that belief. And he made that point to us. So, it was a real life kind of connection with that important event, which actually led to a lot of the Cold War mania that we had around capitalism and communism. I was just able to kind of connect the dots after I started doing some preparation for this show and reading a little bit about William Maguire. But that's the best I could come up with. Is he would say you have to learn this because you have to build up resistance against someone changing your beliefs. Some of these prisoners of war had just never learned at a deep enough level the importance of democratic institutions and democratic systems to combat or have resistance to the challenging that they got from their captors.
I'm fascinated by what you're saying. So resistance now in inoculation theory, we would say inoculated against. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely what it is. And to circle back to what I was talking about earlier, the difference between facts and methodology. So one could give all the facts about democracy versus authoritarian communism, but explaining how how propaganda might work to convince you otherwise has much broader inoculative powers than does the facts. You forget the facts and you could be taught things that are wrong, but explaining they're going to tell you this and what they're trying to do is to convince you of this, that's very powerful.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to remind listeners that we are talking to Professor Melanie Tresick King from Massasoit Community College about the importance of critical thinking as well as science and information literacy.
We've already touched on a few of the strategies, but I'm wondering, are there other specific strategies that people who want to build up their mental immunity, who want to strengthen it, and to be better critical thinkers? You know, we've talked about going through some of these exercises of creating disinformation, misinformation, and inoculation. Are there other specific strategies for those of us who want to become better critical thinkers that we can employ to improve our mental immunity?
So the website mentalimmunityproject.org has a guide to mental immunity. And the guide has, the third part of the guide has 10 specific strategies that you can use, 10 principles. Things like avoid thinking in black or white. Right. Avoid the dichotomy of true, false, yes, no, right, wrong. And instead, think about how true something is likely to be on a spectrum of confidence. Reality, my graduate professor used to always say that reality isn't black or white, it's shades of gray. Right. So reality is complicated and we have a tendency to oversimplify. And so instead of being not just black or white thinkers, but absolutely confident in what we think. Overconfidence is a killer, by the way. So Daniel Kahneman, who famously won a Nobel Prize in part for his work on cognitive biases, was once asked if you had a magic wand that could rid the world of one bias, what would it be? And he said overconfidence. I mean, if you're overconfident in what you think is true, then you're not going to change your mind. You're not teachable, right? You can't learn. Things like, instead of making our beliefs central to who we are, separating your identity from your beliefs. So when a belief that's important to how we see ourselves, to our identity, is threatened, we're presented with evidence that might disprove that belief, we will get defensive to the point where the same part of the brain that would be active in a physical threat is also activated. So try to hold your beliefs more loosely. You are not your belief. I do this exercise with my students where, how many species of elephant do you think there are? Actually, I'm curious.
Two.
I have no idea. It might be one or it might be 40.
Well, that's a huge range. The next thing I would do is, so I would make you answer, Bob, but I won't put you on the spot here. The next thing I would do is say, well, how confident are you? On a scale from 0 to 100%, how confident are you?
25%. Yeah, Bob has a range, though. So
yeah, I have a range. I'm pretty confident. 95% confident that it's somewhere in that range, which means I have no idea.
Okay, fair. How would you feel if you were wrong?
If I was wrong, I'd want to know what the answer was. I'd be curious.
I don't think my identity is too wrapped up with pachyderm at this point in my life.
Oh, you pachyderm. Oh, okay. So that feeling, I don't care. I would change my mind based on what you told me, assuming you have a good reason for what you tell me. That feeling right there is what we're shooting for with all of our other beliefs. Imagine being that untied to human-caused climate change or evolutionary theory or vaccines or GMOs or homeopathy. I mean, whatever it is, right? You would change your mind with evidence. And that's what we're going for. By the way, you would have been right, Julia, probably 25 years ago. There were two. The African and the
African
Asian.
African and the Asian, yeah.
Yeah. So genetic evidence in, I think it was the early aughts, separated the African elephant into two, the savanna and the forest elephant. So today there's three extant species of elephant. But notice, by the way, how facts can change. Like the number of elephant species is a fact. And yet our fact has changed in our lifetime, which means this is what science is doing, is constantly updating with new information. And that's a good thing. People have this like idea that facts are set in stone and can never change. And I suppose reality is set in stone, but our understanding of it can always change. The point here is that feeling of not being so attached to a belief would be what I would want to lean into. And on top of that, another principle, because I realized the idea of being part of a group that isn't tied to its beliefs, more is caring about the processes that lead to truth. So we get a lot of our beliefs from our community, from our social groups. So imagine if you were part of, like Julia, let's say that you were on the left side and the left side firmly believed that there was two, and Bob, you're on the right side and the right side firmly believes, let's say, that there's 40. And now these are identity defining beliefs and they're tribal beliefs, and you are going to disagree with each other vehemently and constantly look for reasons why you're right and why the other side is wrong and so on and so on. As opposed to, you know what, who really cares how many there are? What we want to do is find what reality is. Let's test each other. Are you right about that, Julia? Are you right about that, Bob? Let's ask. Let's try to find a better answer together. So being a part of a community of questioners as opposed to a community of believers.
That's such a key concept. That is the root of a lot of what we talk about on this show and where I personally believe we need to move. But how do we do that? How do we disentangle from our gut-level beliefs and feelings that we so strongly identify with? Are there exercises that we can do? That's great, the contrast you did with the fact of how many elephant species there are, which probably Julie and I never had any kind of emotional investment in. That really hits home, that, and it makes the point. But it causes me to think, that's where we do want to go, but how can we, other than questioning each other, how do we move to that point where we really want to question each other rather than persuade each other?
Well, you just asked the billion-dollar question.
Okay.
Which I had an easy answer for it. I often joke that my class is relatively effective because my students are captive. It's a silly way of joking that for 4 months, they want a grade and they have to stick with me for 4 months as I break down the process of here's how we come to our beliefs. Here's how we question our beliefs. Here's the limits of our perception and memory. Here's how to think better. Here's Nella's focus on information. It's a series of steps. I have not found, I haven't found a shortcut. I don't think there is one. And I don't think that there's, if there's one to do online and in social media, I haven't discovered that yet either. So if you find it, please let me know. I do have a couple of pointers that I think are useful. One, we want to be able to change our minds. But that means that we need to also let other people change their minds. We need to create a space where updating your beliefs with evidence is valued and rewarded as opposed to punished or belittled or something. I also think, and this is the hook that I always use with my communication, humor is such a good medicine. Like, it makes everything else go down better. Really great organizations that are focusing on misinformation, ranging from like evolution and climate change, like we've already talked about. Here's the problem. If I go into a class and I start with climate change, any student who already has that as part of their identity, their social identity, that's an important belief for them, they're not likely to change their mind. So I would go in with humor instead, with not just humor, beliefs that are less triggering. So I actually start Science for Life with witches. I start day one, you know what, I'm going to tell you a story about witches. I don't want you to take notes. What I want you to do is at the end of this, let's talk about why I told you the story. And we talk about witch trials from the 1600s and 1700s in Europe. And the kinds of things people were accused of, the kinds of things people were killed for. Why did they confess? They were tortured. Their confession was proof that they were a witch and that they did any number of things. My students don't believe in witches. So they can look at that belief with sort of a non-emotional attachment. They really thought they were right. How good was their evidence? What am I wrong about? And how would I know? Right? So using non-triggering beliefs and humor as much as possible. I also think that creating an environment where the process is more important than the outcome. This is a harder one. But it's not enough to know how to think critically. You have to want to think critically. So I tend to use what's the harm questions. Today I posted about homeopathy on social media. And for a certain kind of person, that's really triggering. But for me, what is the harm of falling for something like homeopathy? Well, at minimum, you spent probably $30 on something that's just water. Or maybe you were actually sick with something and you're not going to be treated because you took homeopathy instead. Right? What is the worst that can happen from something like that? So changing the frame of mind from the outcome to how we got there of things that we can do involve these kinds of changing how we look at and think about things.
As I asked that question, what popped into my mind too is another way of doing that might be, and I wonder how much of this you do in your classes, sort of experiential things where you maybe ask somebody to put themselves in the place of and role play a person who has an opinion completely different than them so that they kind of vicariously experience what it's like to be that person, whether that might also be kind of a motivating way to get them to disassociate from their own anchor points having to do with their identification and political affiliations.
Yeah, I do a little bit of that. It's not necessarily an experiential way of addressing the situation. I actually fool students at the very beginning of class to prove to them that they can be fooled. And then I draw on that the rest of the semester, like, hey, remember when I fooled you? That really sucked, right? Nobody likes to be fooled. So let's not do that, right? Remember how that feels, some empathy, always assuming good intent from the other person. I say that after I just lied to the students on the first day of class, but nevertheless, I do. It's a dangerous game, but it always seems to work out. When having this conversation with somebody else about the elephants, one of the things I would ask you, so if you were to tell me, Julia, that your answer is two, and I were to say, why might you be wrong? Right? So not why are you right? Why do you say two? But assume that you're wrong. Why might you be wrong? So that process gets you to think of your own reasons for why you might be wrong. I'm not giving you reasons. You're coming up with them yourself. So it's not necessarily an experiential thing, but I think it's a really powerful way. Look, we can't change someone else's mind. Right? They have to change it themselves. And so I can't take my reasoning and say, you know, here, Julia, open up your head. I'm just going to plant this in your head. Now you're convinced, right? Especially when it's something like vaccines that you're really tied to. This would be you coming up with it yourself. You can convince yourself much better than I can.
One aspect that I really like about the Mental Immunity Project is that collaboration of people with diverse backgrounds and interests. And several of the people that are listed as affiliates with the Mental Immunity Project, we've had as guests on Thinking Clearly, like you and Andy Norman, Lee McIntyre, John Guy, Anthony Magnabosco, and John Cook. And I understand that some mental immunity workshops have been held to generate further interest, but are there any plans for other ways, for example, an in-person conference or other way to build momentum for a real growing movement of activists, not just people who are researchers, who are interested in it intellectually or philosophically, but people who are interested in taking the strategies and techniques that have been shown to be effective and putting those out there in the real world to help change things for the better in our information environment?
Yeah, we are working on it. Currently in the process of trying to find funding for an in-person conference. It's definitely something that we are looking at doing. We're also looking at funding for education development. Like, I know I'm biased, but this is the area that appeals to me the most. We're making curriculum and making it available to educators and also hosting workshops to show educators how those might work in their classrooms. So yeah, all of it's a possibility. Hopefully we find the resources to keep continuing the work.
Well, I guess on the topic of elephants, which is apparently a new hobby of mine, since we talked last, there is a new elephant in the room in the guise of large language models or, you know, what people are calling artificial intelligence or, you know, things that are being produced by ChatGPT. So I'm kind of curious, what are your thoughts about whether that will that branch of AI will result in an unstoppable surge of infectious misinformation and disinformation, or if it'll instead turn out to help the cause of mental immunity and critical thinking, or maybe something else altogether?
Yeah, that is an excellent question, and honestly, one that's way beyond my pay grade. I can, based on what... But allow me to give my thoughts anyway. as an educator, these tools scare the poo out of me and are also the new reality that we live in. And I'm pretty sure that educators, since the dawn of time, every time a new technology was introduced, had the exact same thoughts. This one seems particularly game-changing, but they probably always did. Like, you know, Google, for example. I personally use it in class. Like, I know it's a thing. I know students have access to it. And I'd really like a way to be able to tell if students are using it to cheat. We don't currently have that yet. So I ask them to use it to create things that they can then use in class to understand or debunk. Like, for example, one of the exercises I have students do is to create conspiracy theories so that they understand how conspiratorial thinking works. And so I will have them, you know, come up with a conspiracy theory. Are you familiar with the birds aren't real? conspiracy theory.
Yes, I'm very fond of it, actually. Birds are not real. Yeah.
I don't know if you're paying attention. They've got a new book coming out, and it is just brilliant. It's so amazingly brilliant. And all of their publicity stuff, they stay in character. It's all of this game. For those of you who aren't necessarily aware, Birds Aren't Real is a satirical conspiracy theory that claims that all of the birds were killed by the government in the 60s and 70s, and that everything that you see that looks like a bird today is a spy drone. And they charge up by sitting on power lines, and you know, when they poo on your car, it's because they're tracking you, right? And they always have a reason to maintain this conspiracy. It's so funny. So I have my students create conspiracy theories along those lines, as funny as you can possibly be. But conspiracy theories work because they are immune to evidence. Conspiratorial thinking is a rabbit hole. In that any evidence that's missing was hidden. Why else can't you find it? They hid it. Or any evidence that would disprove the conspiracy was planted. That's what they want you to think. There's always a way to make an excuse for the evidence and maintain the conspiracy. So I have the students come up with a conspiracy theory and find evidence for it. And then the power comes when I put them with another group, and the other group is tasked with disproving the conspiracy theory. And the original group has to maintain the conspiracy theory, right? This is where the justifications come that help you constantly maintain this narrative. That is the power of conspiracy theories. Well, those kinds of things are really difficult to come up with, like create a conspiracy theory. I use examples like, the hot dog manufacturers and the hot dog bun manufacturers are constantly putting the wrong numbers in packages just to keep you buying more, right? Whatever it is, something silly. A great shortcut, though, is to plug that into ChatGPT. Say, okay, create a conspiracy theory along the lines of birds aren't real, or, you know, hot dogs or whatever. And it will give you, I did this recently, and it was about how cats are trying to take over the world by convincing us that, like, I'm a cat person, so any cat conspiracy is going to get me. The hard part was that right there, right? So having students use the power of the technology to brainstorm interesting ideas that they can then use to think more critically about or more in depth about, I think is a fun and actually useful way of that technology.
So you use ChatGPT to generate conspiracy theories to help to have students use that to generate. That's brilliant. I love that because it works in your assignment, and it also gives the students the idea of how ChatGPT and other forms of artificial intelligence can be abused and misused. It shows them that could be, and be on the lookout for this, because now this new conspiracy theory might just be ChatGPT being used to give disinformation. And that's one of the fears. I'm very neutral on, and we did have a show when we did one episode on AI, and just to kind of acquaint people with the importance of it and some of the terminology and the pros and cons and that sort of thing. I'm very neutral on it, but hopeful that it can be used for good, and its power can be harnessed to make the world better rather than perpetuate lies and deceit and misinformation and separation between people.
Bob, the eternal optimist.
Yeah. So that's great. Well, we're getting a little short on time, but I do want to get back to this question of the book, because the last episode that we did with you, that was a question that I asked. Is there a book in the works? Because you have approached the topics that you're interested in, critical thinking and science literacy and information literacy. You've approached it creatively, and it seemed to me that, yes, you have your website, you have your courses, and people may be using the courses. Now you have an online course that people can access, but that there might be a book in the works. And we started this episode out knowing that there was one. So can you talk a little bit about that?
I'm just getting back from SciCon, which is the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry's conference. And that question came up quite a bit, to the point where, I don't know if you know who Stuart Weiss is. He just sent me his article, "Don't Ask How the Book is Going." it's so good, but oh my gosh, it's even a bigger undertaking than I had imagined it to be. So I'm going to say, oh my gosh, that question hurts, and it's really important one, and I will come back to you.
Okay. But can I get you to talk a little bit about it? Because, I think anybody who loves ideas and has thought about things has had this thought that I'd like to write a book. Just the process itself, and many people who embark upon that process of writing a book never write a book, never finish the book, because they find out how difficult that can be. But can you tell us a little bit about maybe what you went through with just the process itself?
Yeah, I think part of my problem is that I have two that I'm working on simultaneously, and it's too much. So I actually might use this opportunity for a bit of free professional advice. The two that I'm currently, I need to focus. The one I mentioned to you was How to Be a Charlatan. And the very short version of that was my latest article in Skeptical Inquirer that showed the ways to have students create misinformation in a process of inoculating them against misinformation. And the other one is the essence of my course, Thinking is Power. And I get a lot of requests from people for taking the course, for not necessarily taking the course, but wanting the same content from the course. And so it would be that. And I think they're both eventually going to be done. But right now, my split focus is hampering my progress. So I don't know.
I can offer you an idea. It's one book, part one and part two.
Yeah.
you put it together.
Yeah.
You put it together. And that way you could research the background on some charlatans, some people who have created who get off on manufacturing misinformation. Some people make money by politicizing things and manufacturing misinformation. I read about a guy who, I don't know, he's in his apartment in New Jersey or somewhere, and that's what he did for a living. He would actually, and he had sponsors, he had advertisements, but he would get, it was clickbait, so you could sort of do background on that and include that whole thing, maybe even interview some of those folks and get into what the process of and motivation for being a charlatan is and how that's done. That's part one. And then part two is the contrast to someone who wants to be, wants to know what the truth is and is really looking to find out what reality really is rather than manufacture it. That would be my idea.
Yeah, that's a great idea. One of the ongoing frustrations is that it turns out it's easier to get people to waste their money on useless crap than it is to get them to save their money. Back to the harm question, I always joke with my students that part of the harm is this stuff costs money. I'm too cheap to waste my money on things that don't actually provide me value. But that kind of stuff, what they're doing is they're selling hope. And the hope is awfully powerful. They're paying money for hope. But in the process, they're giving a charlatan money that's just taking advantage of them. And the other side of that is critical thinking, in my estimation, is like the world's best empowerment. It's the world's best self-help skill. Like, how do you protect yourself from bunk? How do you make wiser decisions? It's through thinking better. There's no shortcut to this, right? And so we all think that we're good at thinking, but actually learning how to think better is the best way to solve, if you have any chance at solving any of your problems, it's through better thinking. But it's not as flashy as the stuff with like pseudoscience goop things on the
front. Yeah, but I think you've just made a good case for the conclusion of your part two of your book is that understanding reality accurately gives us so much more advantage. I mean, it's been the advantage that human beings have had and why we've been successful, in my opinion. If you're distorting reality, not searching for the truth, you're doing a disservice to yourself and you're not using the full power of being a human being. At any rate, we're about out of time. I like to say the sand has run out of our hourglass. So Melanie Teresa King, I want to thank you so much for being with us a second time on Thinking Clearly and updating us with your work teaching, promoting critical thinking and science and information literacy now on our Facebook page. And by the way, I'm envious of your Facebook page. You have like, what, 49,000 followers or something like that? That's incredible. Maybe off air, I'll ask you how you built your Facebook page to that extent. We need to work on ours a little bit. But on our Facebook page, we're going to post a link to your website, thinkingispower.com, and to your author page at Skeptical Inquirer. That is a wonderful article. I want to congratulate you on that. And to the links at the Mental Immunity Project. So are there any other links that you'd like us to post, Melanie?
I don't think so. No, thank you very much.
I just want to give a big thanks to our listeners. Thanks for tuning us in. And as always, Julia, thank you so much. And until next time, keep thinking
clearly. Just be sure to do your who, what, where, when.